Hey everybody, welcome back to the Lancecast. I'm your host, Matt.
And I'm Tyler.
So, welcome to the Lancecast. I am very happy that we're here. We did miss last week. Tyler was sick as a dog, so we had to take the last week off. So, he's feeling better, which is always a good thing. And I am here. I don't know about feeling ready and raring to go and doing this, but you know what? By the time we get into it, I'll find my motivation. Also, I can't see anything because my glasses are here and not on my face. So, Tyler, well, I'm putting my glasses on. You can tell us what you've been doing in the world of FOSS this week.
Well, so when I got sick, as soon as I started feeling better, like I could actually I didn't even want to sit down and use the computer. I felt so bad. But as soon as I started feeling better, I immediately did what I'm best at and started distro hopping aggressively. And so I tried out a whole bunch of different distros, hopped. I checked out like Garuda Dragon Eyes for the first time in a long time. I mean, I tried out a whole bunch of different stuff. Very much was enjoyable trying out everything, but I ended back up on OpenBSD, which I did not think was going to happen, but with Mental Outlaw giving me a shout out and talking about my OpenBSD content, I was like, you know what? It has been a while since I've checked out OpenBSD, and then I wasn't going to keep running it because they still have not been able to fix the ACPI error with my motherboard. I have a Gigabyte board. It has like some super IO BS with it. And so whenever the ACPI part of the kernel like loads and during boot up, it just like all my fans will just stop spinning on motherboard headers. But I just plugged in my Noctua fan with a, what's that thing called? The low noise adapter. I plugged that into the Molex in my computer, and you know, obviously cooling's fine. So I just went ahead and started using it, and man, it's been nice. It's been nice getting back into it. I really like OpenBSD. And I've also been playing some games on it, and by games I mean stuff like I played Far Cry Primal earlier on OpenBSD, which was kind of fucking awesome. Let's see, I played Golf with Your Friends. Like, I played a whole bunch of different games, but we'll talk about what that was through towards the end, because that's actually, like, my thing of the week.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, it's been nice.
I have some comments on your OpenBSD thing here in a minute, but I need to address the chat. Yes, Tyler's audio is out of sync. If you're watching this live, or you're watching this later, yes, Tyler's audio sometimes goes out of sync. He's on OpenBSD, as you just heard, and that's not a real operating system. It's fake, so it has some issues. If he was using a real man's operating system, GNU/Linux, he wouldn't be having these issues. I'm just going to put that out there. Also, sure. Mislav, sure. Thanks for the super sticker thing, that whatever it is. I appreciate that. All right. Also, I have no clue what that sticker actually is. Oh, those are sunglasses. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think.
Those are cool guy sunglasses.
I am so old. These stickers. Well, back in my day, we actually had paper stickers. If you wanted a sticker, you had to unpeel it. we're aware of the audio problems. We'll fix that once Tyler hops back to a real operating system.
Once I do.
Notice that I said when, and that leads me into my commenting on you. So first of all, congratulations on the call out by Mental Outlaw. That was pretty awesome. I'm assuming that your subscribers went up a little bit.
Yeah. Since the shout out, I've gained like 500 to 600 subscribers.
That's really, really cool, man.
Which is really nice. But I will go ahead and say I'm much happier. Root has gained a lot more subscribers from the shout out, which I really like. If you're really looking for OpenBSD content, I mean, sure, I've got it, but I'd highly recommend going checking out Root's channel. He's a great guy, and he's got some fantastic OpenBSD content. So I'm glad his channel's getting a lot of recognition. just great.
Yeah, the funniest part about the whole Mental Outlaw thing was that he shouted you out for OpenBSD content when your latest ones had nothing to do with OpenBSD.
Yeah. He was talking about my OpenBSD content, and when he loaded up my channel, all you see is my Unreal Engine 5 live streams.
On Windows. Windows. It was on Windows, and it was the furthest thing you could get away from OpenBSD.
Yeah.
It was so funny. Yeah. Anyway, so the last I knew, you were on Gen 2. So you went to OpenBSD because of the Mental Outlaw thing, or just was there something wrong with Gen 2?
Well, I guess I should say yes to both, because I really wasn't thinking about going to OpenBSD, but because of everyone talking about the Mental Outlaw video, I was like, you know what, I should at least go ahead and give it a shot. So I mean, it's definitely a little bit because of the shout out, but yes, I was having issues on Gen 2 for some reason. Games that should just open weren't, and then I was like, you know what, well, before I just say screw it and just go to OpenBSD and do like just cloud gaming when I want a game, I was like, well, I will go ahead and try Ubuntu and see if like just if everything is just working, will I enjoy Snaps? And the answer to that question is no. Like Snaps still have some issues, like definitely. They're not terrible, but they still get, like, it's such a nitpick, but the loopback devices with Snaps is just so annoying.
I know.
It really is.
There's so much about Snaps that we could talk about, but we don't need to do that. We can wait until the main topic, actually.
Yeah.
A little bit of a lead in there. Okay, so for me, this last week, actually, I've done very little in terms of what's interesting stuff on Linux. I've just been working like a lot, but last week I was ricing up a storm because I'm creating a script that will allow me to switch rices through Rofi, and the script is written. It works. Mm-hmm. Like if I wanted to switch between, like right now I'm using OneDark. If I wanted to switch to Grubbox or Tokyo Night or something like that, it works. Like I have a ton of rice is already done. It will change the i3 theme, it'll change the Polybar theme, it'll change the Alacrity theme, and it will, when I'm done with it, it's also going to change the GTK theme and the wallpaper. I would love to figure out a way to change the NeoVim theme from the script. That'd be awesome. I have not figured out how to do that yet. Hopefully that is something that I can figure out. Otherwise, that'll have to be manual. But if I can work all that out, it will switch everything through a key binding. And I can, like, I've been changing rices once a day. like yesterday, I was using Grubbox Powerline. And the day before that, I was using just regular Grubbox. And then today, I'm using OneDark. Who knows what tomorrow will bring. I want to do an Everforest or whatever it's called, a rice like that. Mm-hmm. And I want to do another Grubbox theme because I found a rice of somebody else's Grubbox theme, which is really freaking awesome. So I'm going to try to emulate that. And then there's so many rice, so many different themes that I can do. I'm going to have one of each and then have like 50 or 60 different themes I can switch between. It's going to be awesome. And I got so I actually did that script on a stream, and when I did it, it was like, I don't know, 25, 30 lines, because I had one line for each theme, and I got it down now, so it's one line after the array. So after it lists out all of the choices, and then the Rofi has the Rofi line where it pipes everything into Rofi, and then it has the part that it actually does the changing, and that's just one line. So I was really proud of that. That contribution was inspired by a fix that came through from Schmoig, whatever his name is, from the Discord.
Yeah.
So that was really fun. So I'm really I've been posting pictures of my rices on Discord. Like, you changed rices again? Yeah, I did. You're never going to see me use the same rice 2 days in a row.
Well, that's actually probably what I should do, is instead of, like, distro hopping all the time, you know, just rice hop constantly.
You should distro hop one more time away from BSD.
I don't know. I really do like it. It's real nice.
So let me ask you this question. I've never used BSD, so would you have better luck with, like, the audio and stuff like that on a different version of BSD, like FreeBSD or GhostBSD or something? Or would it just have the same problems?
I honestly can't answer that because I don't know. FreeBSD, like, really, in all honesty, like, BSDs are different than distro, like, Linux distros. Like, they're kind of similar. Like, Linux distros can be different. Like, they can have different default choices, like, for audio, Pipewire, or Pulse. And it's kind of similar with BSD, except for they're completely different. Like, they don't share the same kernel either. Like, FreeBSD's kernel is not... completely, but it's massively different than the OpenBSD kernel, and so also their tools can be very different. And so for FreeBSD, I don't know, you might have more luck with audio issues, but really, in all honesty, the only audio issues that I have here is the delay through Discord, which I know is most likely just a Discord issue, because in other things like Jitsi, or I can't remember what the other, I don't think it was Element. I'm pretty sure it was. It was something else, but it doesn't have issue. Was it TeamSpeak? I don't know, but another one of the chat applications, it doesn't have any issues at all, and I used that for a while. Same with Jitsi. But Jitsi, it's the same thing as Discord. Like, really, when it comes to, like, these kind of, like, chat applications online, like, I haven't found one that's literally rock solid reliable. There's just not one for video and audio.
Well, we'll try Jitsi again next week if you're still on BSD.
We'll at least try it, but I don't want... We should probably do something where if we are going to try it, we try it privately, like, before the day that we record the podcast.
We can do that.
That way... Yeah, we can, like, test it for a good 30 minutes to an hour to make sure that there's, like, no issues, and also you don't have to set up the, like, transforms and everything if it's not going to work out.
See,
whatever.
The thing is, remember last time we tried Jitsi, we tried it 1 week, and we raved about it like crazy. Like, it was like, this is the greatest thing we've ever tried, we should have done this ages ago, and then the week after that, it gave us problems.
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't know.
Hopefully that's no longer the case, but I don't know. Discord's got a lot of money behind it, so I struggle to see how Jitsi's going to improve on problems that plague Discord.
Well, but I mean, we could try Zoom if we had to.
And now at that point, it's Linux time. If we're really and truly considering Zoom, it's time to go.
You should definitely switch to Linux, and you should, like I said, real man's operating system with a proper kernel.
All right. All right.
Moving on to the. You can't win, by the way. Just to let you know that if you use Windows, I give you shit. You use BSD, I give you shit. Maybe if you.
Even if I use Linux, I still get shit.
I'm
not using the right one.
Well, you should be using Arch. I mean, it's just...
Of course.
I mean, the weeks you use Arch, you get no shit. Like, you're using a proper distro then. Anyways, moving on to the contact information. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so in any number of ways. You can find most of this stuff at thelinuxcast.org, which is the website, which is not an updated website. Somebody asked, messaged me, and was like, you know that your website's way far behind, right? Like, yeah, I know. We're working on it. Well, I should say... One of my patrons is working on it. J-Dog's working on it, or he says he's working on it. I don't know what solution we're coming up with, but we're coming up with some solution where it's easier for me to update other than actually writing out manually HTML code. to update this thing line by line, because that's obviously entirely too much work. Anyways, you can also find Tyler on YouTube at youtube.com/ZanyOG. He's also on Odyssey and Discord. You can find those links in the video description as well. Also on the linuxcast.org/contact, which is where all this stuff it can be found. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/linuxcast, and you can find daily Linux content, actual Linux content, none of this OpenBSD crap, at youtube.com/thelinuxcast. Yes. I feel like I'm forgetting
something. OpenBSD content one of these days. One of these days. Trust me.
I've been asked to do BSD before. I was like, the thing is, and I'm sure it would get some, like, views or whatever. I'm sure it's not so far out of the realm of, you know, my audience that it would drive a whole bunch of people away, but I don't know. I think out of laziness or stubbornness, I just haven't done it. So, maybe someday. Anyways, Tyler, every week you and I get together and we scour the interweb for the most updated breaking news stories, the only news that you'll ever see that actually matters. There's nothing else going on in the world other than the two links that we're about to share with you today. You tell them, buddy.
Yeah, buddy. Come here.
It's good news.
Yeah. He's preparing to hear this name. Linus Torvalds. Yeah, that's right, buddy. But so my article is kind of interesting. I think some people will find it interesting. Others will be like, you know, this is a meme. A meme is getting into the Linux distro or Linux kernel. But yeah, so Rust is definitely coming to the Linux kernel, and according to Linus Torvalds, it will be in the kernel very shortly, possibly, if not the next release. And really, I find it interesting that we are going to get Rust in the kernel. I think it's probably a good thing, but also, like, to everybody who's like, this is like super big news, I mean, Linus has said himself, like, they tried C++, introducing that in the kernel for a couple weeks, and then they just stopped. So there's definitely a good chance that could happen. This is not like the Linux kernel is going to slowly migrate to being 100% Rust. I mean, it's not like that wild. It's just, hey, if you like Rust and you think that there's some benefits like that come with Rust, then good, because it's getting introduced into the kernel too. And if you hate Rust, then, well, stop pouting, okay? It's fine. It's okay. It's just a language. It won't touch you. It's okay.
I guess there's no bad touch going on, okay?
Yeah. It's all right.
So the thing about this is, for me, I find it more entertaining that the people who write about this in some, like, tech blogs have no clue what's happening, because they're like, oh, the Linux kernel is going to be rewritten in Rust. Like, no, it's not. Like, the Linux kernel is like 30 million lines long. That is not getting rewritten in any other language. It's going to stay exactly as it is. Now, will we see pieces of it rewritten? Probably. But from what I've heard, it's mostly going to be drivers and stuff, because that's where it will do the most good.
According to Linus, really what they're looking for with Rust is its memory. It's like memory safety and like kind of management is something that they think is probably a good thing to have in the kernel. And it might make things just easier on them. But again, this is like a trial run. So who knows? It might go well. It might fizzle out real quick. Have no idea. But it's definitely interesting, especially if you're into Rust. There's probably, like, I would say there's probably going to, if the Linux kernel adopts Rust, that's a good thing for people who are not, I wouldn't say invested in Rust, but, you know, have spent the time to, like, learn Rust and everything. There might be a practical implementation job-wise eventually with it. If things like the Linux kernel start adopting Rust and it becomes more of an industry standard, then if you've learned Rust, then that's awesome. You have an extra skill, an extra in your career path. But I really don't think this is news where, like, oh my god, yeah, the kernel's finally adopting Rust. This is going to fix so many problems. Like, no. This is, it's just neat. It's some cool news happening. That's really it.
The most entertaining thing that you can, like, you think the distro wars are bad. Like, people are like, oh, I use Arch, by the way. I use Gen 2. I use Slackware, whatever. You think those are bad. The most entertaining, like, debate is between developers who absolutely have their language that they like, and they hate other languages. So, like, if you are a C programmer, you despise Python. Like, you hate Python with a burning passion of a thousand suns. If you're a Python developer, you hate Rust. Like, like, how dare this newcomer around the block come take our, you know, our spotlight? Like, two people in my Discord server were going at it the other day, are going between Rust and Python. I was like, and they were so, it got so bad, they were like, they were name calling. Like they were calling each other idiots. Like, come on, man. It's just a freaking programming language. One's not really any better than the other. They all have their flaws. Like, Rust is not a perfect programming language. Like, I'm not a developer, but I know that it's not perfect because nothing is perfect. You know what I mean? Cause well, it has flaws. Like, just like C has flaws. C++ has flaws. Python has flaws. I mean, come on. You use the tool that's best for the job. That's the way it's always should have been. If they think that Rust is going to be good for the Linux kernel, that's going to be fantastic. And I somewhat trust them, at least, to know that if it doesn't do any good, they'll just stop, you know, and focus on something else. All right.
So what about you? What's yours?
I honestly don't remember. I chose this last week, so... all right. So Mozilla has enabled, in the latest version of Firefox, something called Total Cookie Protection. And from what I understand of this, basically what this means is that your browser will still accept cookies from websites, right? It will accept cookies just like it would normally would, except for it's going to take those cookies and basically put them in a container so that those cookies can only talk to that website, no other website. So that means that if Facebook puts a cookie on your computer, that cookie can't then be accessed by the trackers that rely on other websites, so it can't tell you that you're the worst one about this. Like, I don't know if you've ever visited a Medium blog, like a Medium blog on the internet, and if you're logged into Google, you'll see in the upper right hand corner, it'll say, would you like to sign into Medium? Like, what? I don't have an account on Medium. Why would I want to sign? But yeah, it's there's some kind of Google tracker there that says, well, you're signed into Google, therefore you can sign into Medium. Like, and this happens all across the internet. So that's what this is kind of aiming to protect you from. I haven't seen a lot of pushback. I thought that there kind of would be, because, I mean, yes, cookies are kind of, you know, security problems, right? We all know this, and they're privacy things that we worry about, but if you've ever used, like, LibreWolf, like, you use that without changing anything, that thing doesn't accept cookies at all. That means every time you open up the browser, you have to re-log into everything. Like, yep. Like, that's the problem with not having cookies. Like, I don't know about anybody else, but I hate logging into stuff, so I leave everything logged in as much as possible. It's not, I know that's not as, like, the only thing I log out of is the things that, like, really matter. Like, I log out of my credit cards and banks. Those things get logged out as soon as I'm done with them. Other than that, like, yeah, I mean, YouTube, but I mean, I have two-factor authentication enabled, and I got a security key or whatever, and that's as much as I, much protection I want. This whole total cookie protection thing, I'm not sure how that's going to change. Like, they say that they can implement this thing and it not, you know, like, break the web, but I'm not sure. Like, it'll be interesting to see how this actually affects your browsing experience, because if it negatively affects your browsing experience, from my experience, people are going to hate it, because people don't really care about privacy so much. They really want their browser to work, and if it starts breaking stuff, they're going to switch, right?
Yeah. Hopefully this, like, it seems like this wouldn't cause any breakages at all. It just really pisses off the companies that want to track you, which I mean, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's just, like, this, it's weird that it's taken this long for something like this to get put in Firefox, because I've always thought it was wild that LibreWolf was the, like, alternative. It's like, either you have a extremely convenient feature that you probably, everyone would want out of a browser. Like, you want a site to remember where you were the last time you were. Like, that's just, it's a super convenient, nice feature. But your only choice is where you either have the feature and you get tracked all across the internet, or you just
don't have the feature. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no middle ground, right? And that sucks, because it'd be great to have just the good cookies, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's weird that, like, containers are not, like, a new idea. So, like, it's weird that it's taken this long for it to get here, but that's not me griping about it. Like, I'm just happy it's here. I find it weird that we had to wait so long for it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the idea of containerizing a cookie to its tab is probably not a revolutionary idea. It just, I guess maybe it was very extremely difficult to implement, which, I mean, I know nothing about developing a browser, and from everything that I hear, it's kind of remarkably hard, so I'm going to assume that's it. Like,
it has to be hard if, I mean, Mozilla employs 800 people, so obviously they're having some difficulties. Yeah. You wouldn't think it would take that many people to develop a browser, but what the hell do we know? Like, I think the Q browser guy, that's just like one dude.
Yeah.
So, but granted, he uses somebody else's, what is that, Qt Web Engine or whatever? So he uses somebody else's web engine, so he doesn't have to do the hard part.
Nope.
I don't know. Which
is probably the only way he develops a browser, if we're being honest.
It would be cool to be talented enough, a developer, to come up with a way to make, like, a new web browser, like an actual new web browser. But it does seem like it's beyond, like, even big corporations. So, like, Brave... No, we're not making our own. We're just going to take Chromium. DuckDuckGo is like, we're going to do some other things. I don't know what the hell we're going to do, but we're not making our own browser. We're going to confuse the hell out of everybody. So you have to... I'll say this. Like, I know every time we talk about Mozilla, we somehow come down on bashing them, but it honestly surprises me that they've continued to use their own web engine. Would have thought that they would have just switched to Chromium. I mean, I'm glad that they haven't. I'm not saying that they should abandon Gecko or whatever it's called.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
But I'm surprised in this day and age where it seems to be so hard to do this. And it is obviously hard because Firefox has its own issues when it comes to rendering stuff. So they obviously have some issues, right? I'm surprised that they haven't just said, you know, screw it, we're going to take Chromium, just like Microsoft did. And we'll put our skin on top of it and fork it from there. Like I said, I'm glad they haven't, but it honestly wouldn't surprise me if that happens eventually, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Internet.
I mean, at that point, they probably will stop getting their handout money from Google, but
probably. And then they will. Well, if they stop, see, the thing is, if they stop developing their own web engine, they won't have to employ 750 people. You know. Most of those guys are going to be working on the web engine. You know that.
Yeah,
Internet Explorer died, which is... That happened after we chose these links, I think. But, yeah. If anybody's... I would love to know if there was actually anybody that was not in a company that was still using Internet Explorer. Like, you have that, like, one 95-year-old grandmother who refuses to upgrade from Windows XP. And is still using, like, Internet Explorer 11 or something.
I don't know. I with how broken Internet Explorer can be with the modern web, I highly doubt anybody was still running it, like, who was not into computers, just because getting Internet Explorer nowadays to function on some websites is just as much of a headache as it is to install a different browser and just use it. There are so many different websites that won't work on Internet Explorer anymore. Don't ask me how I know that, because I don't even know how I know that.
Oh, no, I'm sure
like
you're right.
It's not like I use Internet Explorer.
But I'm because, I mean, they just killed it off, so they were obviously still updating something. I mean, Because, honestly, I saw that news. I was like, wait a minute. Internet Explorer wasn't already dead? Like, I thought we killed that thing years ago.
Yeah.
Like, I know that in Windows 10, at least, you could still get to Internet Explorer. Like, it still came pre-installed. Mm-hmm. So that means that they were still expecting at least somebody to use it. God, that's such a problem with Windows. Like, they really like their old legacy shit. Like, mm-hmm. like they need to learn how, like they need to let it go. You know, like they got that song going on in the background. Let it go, please. Like, for the love of God, let it go. Anyway, so yeah, I wanted to say one more thing about Firefox. I made a story about a story entry on YouTube about this, but I've been having problems with Firefox again because for whatever reason. Like, I've turned off, so I use the Mozilla account sync, right? So I can sync between computers and my phone. And it's great. Like, that's a great feature. I think everybody should use it if they use Firefox in multiple places. But one of the things that I have turned off there is the ability to sync the themes. Like, I don't want my theme to sync from computer to computer because I use a different Rice on every computer. Because, of course, I do. Mm-hmm. Right? But it ignores the fact that that's turned off. So every time I get up to stand at the standing desk and use Firefox on that computer, I come back to this computer and it's completely removed my theme. It's frustrating. Like the syncing is off, so I don't know why it continues to do it. So it just the thing is, I've been using Firefox now happily for a few months. Like I was going through that period where I was looking for a new browser. Like I don't know. Every week or so. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. I was going through browsers like you go through Linux distributions. It was nuts. But I've been using Firefox now for a few months now, like straight, like no other browser's installed, and it works fine. But every once in a while something crops up, it's just like, God, why does it suck sometimes? Like, why can't you just fix the bug? Stop introducing new features. Alright. But anyways, I'll stop complaining about Firefox now. Moving on, for now, I should say, not forever. I'm sure that will come back. Moving on to the main topic. So this week's topic, I'm not sure who came up with any of these topics anymore. We really haven't been paying attention to that. We used to switch back and forth. But anyways, this week's main topic is, and the question that I've posed is Canonical evil? And I kind of want to actually expand this just a little bit to include Red Hat too, because Red Hat gets just as much hatred as Canonical does. So, but we can start off with Canonical. So, for those of you who don't know, if you're brand new to the Linux community, you're like, who the fuck is Canonical? Canonical is the corporation behind Ubuntu. They do all of the Ubuntu stuff. They are the primary sponsors behind the Ubuntu desktop, and they develop a whole bunch of open source and non-open source software. And their primary means of making money is through supporting Ubuntu on the server. So that's how they make their cash. For those of you wondering if the Ubuntu desktop is a profitable endeavor for Ubuntu, no, not even close. They make zero money on Ubuntu desktop. Like, I'm sure because every time you download Ubuntu from their site, they take you to that donate page. I'm sure there are some people who donate to them. Personally, if I were going to donate to a Linux distribution, it'd be one of the smaller ones, but that's just, you know, me. And I think that kind of leads into, like, I would never give money to Canonical because they are a corporation, they make money. I don't need to worry about them running out of money. Like, I have to worry about, like, Arch Linux or, you know, Elementary OS or something like that running out of money. So the question is, then, is Canonical as evil as a lot of the people in the Linux community seem to think that it is? Tyler, what is your answer?
No. No, they're not evil. They're just successful, and also, well, extremely corporatized. So they make decisions, like a corporation, that bite them in the ass. Like, Microsoft is not nearly beholden to public opinion like Canonical is. I mean, Microsoft has the advantage of, they've kind of weaseled their way into being a central part of a lot of companies or people's computing experiences. So, like, if they do something that you don't like, you still might just have to put up with it because you need Windows to do whatever, or the company requires it, or whatever. So, like, they have that advantage where Canonical just doesn't. Like, if you need to use Linux, you don't need to use Ubuntu. Like, that's not really a thing. You can go somewhere else. So if they do something that bites them in the ass, like, I don't know, making a deal with Amazon to give you Amazon search results in your own, like, launcher, that everybody hates, then, well, it's directly more, like, they notice the impact much more, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing. Like, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. But they don't have that advantage like Microsoft. And so, like, whenever they do think like a corporation and make those deals in the interest of money, but could also ruin a relationship with the end user, it actually affects them, which is a good thing, and it's much more public. Like, I don't know, in the FOSS community, we're much more vocal. Like, we may be a minority, but we're a very vocal minority, so you hear about their blunders much more than Microsoft, because, I mean, it's just kind of a thing. When there's a problem in Linux, you hear about it more.
Yeah, a good example of that is when they were going to drop the 32-bit libraries from Ubuntu, and I was like, what are you doing there, Ubuntu? That's pretty stupid. How are we going to run Steam games without 32-bit libraries? You know what I mean? I mean, people freaked the fuck out about that without even realizing, like, you in Starch Arch Linux, you don't get the 32-bit libraries. You have to enable that shit. You know what I mean? You have to go into pacman.conf and enable the multi-lib, right? It's literally the same. Like, Gentoo, you want to use 32-bit libraries, you have to compile your kernel in order to actually do that. Like, you have to set the use flags and everything that you need to do in order to get the 32-bit stuff. Literally every other distribution, like, outside of, like, Fedora, like, any of the ones that you, like, build yourself or have any say in, you know, you have to enable the 32-bit libraries yourself. The only ones that come with 32-bit library stuff pre-enabled is those ones that are built for you, like Ubuntu and Elementary OS and Pop and stuff like that. So that whole brouhaha when that came out, like, was baffling to me. But you're right. When everybody freaked out about that, they almost immediately backtrack. Like,
no. Microsoft, well, because they have to. Like, they are beholden to that public image much more than Microsoft is. And I think also, too, that comes with, or leads, I guess, into the other thing that I was going to say about how they're different and how they're kind of held to a different standard. If they're successful, and once you're successful in the Linux space, there's not nearly as much incentive for people to give you donation money. Just because it's a psychological thing. Like, when people know that you're not hurting for money, they're more likely to try and seek out other projects that are hurting for money that they like. And so that makes it to where by necessity, Canonical's, like, focus shifts from the actual desktop end users to their enterprise partners and, like, what's important to them, what can make them or their lives easier. And I think that's really what makes the public perception of them being evil so popular, is because they essentially, for money, and since they're a corporation, for them to exist, they have to get as much money as possible. They end up focusing on the side of the public that's not that interested in how much money you're already making, like end users are. If you're hyper successful, which I think everybody can say in the Linux space, Ubuntu and Canonical are definitely hyper successful. You're not nearly as likely to start giving it money, which means they by design get less and less focused on what you want as a desktop user. Like, it's not that they don't care, but they obviously have a higher priority elsewhere.
Their focus is where the money comes from. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that leads into the idea that they're evil. It's not that they're evil, it's just that they have to have their priorities in a different place. Just the way shit works. I don't think they're evil. Like, long story short, I don't think they're evil. I think because they're a corporation, they from time to time make decisions in the interest of money that directly hurt them in a bigger way than it would something like Microsoft. Which, I don't think is a bad thing. Like, that's a good that's not them being evil. That just means obviously they're a corporation, they're made up by people. People make mistakes and people can be dumb sometimes. And so obviously a group of people, which is what a company or corporation is, they can also be stupid and make mistakes from mm-hmm. time to time. And Ubuntu ends up being more likely to cave to public backlash and public pressure just because there is so many other options in the Linux space, and there's not that in the Microsoft world. So when they start doing stuff that a large majority, even if it's not the enterprise people, but desktop users start freaking out over, they have to take it with a much more productive mindset than Microsoft would. Because Microsoft, I think we all know, can ignore the shit out of what people think or what people have opinions on. They'll just completely ignore it much easier than the enterprise Linux space will. If a large majority of people are uproaring about something, they at least, if they don't address it, they are forced to acknowledge it's a problem and have to state what they either plan to do to fix it or why they don't plan on fixing it, whether you like it or not. Microsoft will just be like, we didn't even know there was a problem. Like, come on, man. Like, but I think that's it.
There's so much here that we could talk about because there's well, first, let me just address, I think one of the reasons why they're more sensitive to public backlash is because a lot of their support, like not necessarily monetary support, but like developer support, comes from the community. Like, when you make your developers unhappy, you're going to have a hard time keeping a project that is as big as Ubuntu going, because a lot of the open source stuff that Ubuntu utilizes to be Ubuntu comes from outside of Canonical. You know, GNOME being one of those, like the biggest one, you know what I mean? Like, but there's many other, examples of that. So when your developers throw a hissy fit about something, you're going to listen. And one of the things, because the developers in the open source community are much more entrenched, I mean, like every developer who develops open source software and Linux software, they're just as much a member of the Linux community as you or I are. You know what I mean? They're just like us, only they actually contribute stuff other than a podcast. You know what I mean? They have this, they're members of the community, therefore they hear just as much of the criticism and stuff like that. And then when they make a noise about something that Ubuntu does, they're going to have to, you know, do something about it. So I think that's one of the reasons. But there's other things about this question to answer. So I think the reason why this gets bandied about so much isn't because necessarily Canonical itself is considered evil. I don't think that very many people actually think that at all. I think instead people have this idea that corporations themselves are inherently immoral because of their need to make money, Right. The idea that they have to turn a profit each month somehow correlates into the idea that they're not the paragons of moral virtue that, you know, they should be because they're an open source company. You know what I mean? That's the reason why people freak out, because the Snap Store is not open source. Like, they think that the Canonical is this open source company, and therefore everything that they should do should be open source. That's the reason why, you know, people freak out about that, right? But there's this idea, like I said, that you're a corporation, therefore you are, you know, not moral. You're not part of the open source ethos. You know what I mean? It's all of these things. And Red Hat gets the same kind of thing because, you know, they're owned by IBM now. But even when they weren't owned by IBM and they were just a standalone company, they were still treated with this idea amongst a lot of people in the Linux community that because they were a corporation and they had ways of making money, they were therefore not bearers of the interest of the Linux community. Like, they're not out for the little guy anymore. They're there for the corporate partners.
Yeah, and, I mean, that's really true, because, and I think especially with people who are, like, older than I am, who have been entrenched in Linux for a long time, I think that idea is very pervasive, only because, especially in the past, there's been an active move by corporations that weren't open source against open source ideals, FOSS ideals. So I think by nature, especially if you've been in Linux for long enough, there is a healthy distrust of corporations entering into the FOSS community, or just like corporations in the FOSS community themselves. Like, it's not that there's a complete distrust of them, but there's at least a healthy amount of distrust for most people about the corporations in and around open source. Like, actually, somebody in chat said, what triggers me from a Windows user is why it's always Canonical that's evil, and nobody's ever talking about Red Hat or OpenSUSE. And, like, I think there is a healthy distrust of all corporations that get involved in open source, at least to some extent. I think Canonical gets most of the attention because, for one, they're what made desktop Linux popular, and now, since their focus is not on desktop Linux, there's a lot of people that do have that healthy amount of distrust go, well, since they're not focused on the thing that doesn't generally provide them the most revenue, then they must just be the soulless version of a corporation where they've just completely given up on making a good product that can be given out for free. It's now just, let's soak up as much money as possible. Let's do anything we can and everything we can to make a dollar. And I understand that idea, but I don't think it's really accurate. Like, yes, Canonical has made some bad decisions in the pursuit of money, but they don't typically double down on their bad decisions. When everybody tells Canonical that you've made a piss-poor decision, they do typically roll it back. They just go back.
And I don't
which
even
is
think...
not something... Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I don't think it's even think it's about bad decisions, because I think that Canonical could put together perfection. Like, they could make every decision correct, and there'd still be a significant portion of the FOSS community that would distrust them because they're a corporation. We know that this is the truth, because the same thing happens to the Red Hat people. And the person who said that in the chat about why Red Hat doesn't get the same thing, they do. We like, seriously, just look at Systemd, okay? Developed mainly by the Red Hat Corporation. And there is a very small but vocal part of the FOSS community that absolutely despises Systemd. Like, they hate it. Like, same thing with Paul. I mean, literally, you can name the technology that we use. Systemd, Pulse Audio, Pipewire, Wayland, many GNOME. Like, literally, all these things developed by the Fedora and Red Hat guys, right? And every single one of them has a small but vocal community that is absolutely hates those things because they're developed by Red Hat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Ubuntu. They develop things like, you know, Ubuntu, the Ubuntu desktop. They have all these different flavors, and they have different underlying technologies that they've developed over the years. You know, and like Tyler, you said, Ubuntu may, like, with the thing that gets me about this whole conversation, right? Whether you're talking about Canonical or Red Hat, doesn't really matter. This whole idea that these two corporations, like it's Red Hat and Canonical, without either of these two corporations and their money, desktop Linux would not exist. Well, excuse me, it would exist, but it would be 20 years behind. You know what I mean? It'd still be in the 1990s, you know, or the early 2000s in terms of, you know, the reason why, like, we bitch about audio a lot on this podcast, but the reason why audio is as good as it is on Linux is because of Ubuntu and Red Hat. You know, and the reason why you can capture a screen on your Linux desktop is because of the work of these companies. You know, every single piece of the GNU/Linux, you know, thing that we all love and enjoy has been touched by these two companies. And it's like, I don't want to say like, oh yeah, well, because Canonical and Red Hat do these things, you know, they're saints or whatever. Like, they are flawed corporations. Like Tyler said, there's a ton of, you know, the examples where Canonical and Red Hat have made the wrong decisions. That's just, I mean, they're made up of people. People are inherently not perfect, you know, not even close, right? And they're going to make crap decisions, you know, from time to time. So the thing that, like, I don't want to, like, say, well, like, well, they've done all this stuff for, like, out of the goodness of their heart. No, they're still, the developers behind Systemd, you know, at least now, aren't doing, continuing their work because, you know, it's the best thing for, like, the people. It's not all altruistic. It's because it supports, you know, RHEL or something like that. You know, same thing with the development of, you know, Pipewire and Wayland and stuff like that. That is the future of the Linux desktop. It's also being developed with the thought in mind that this can help push the future of Linux in the enterprise. You know, yes, there is capitalistic ideas behind a lot of the development of these tools. So it's not altruistic in that sense, but it benefits the greater desktop, Linux desktop community. And the idea that, I know I posed the question, are they evil? Like, is Canonical evil? But, and I think that that's the question that gets asked a lot, but I don't think that you can say any of that is evil unless you consider all capitalistic ideas evil. You have to kind of think that you have to take the evil word out of it. Like, it's about morality. You know what I mean? It's not about, are they out to get you? I mean, you can talk about, is Google evil? That's a good conversation. You know what I mean? Is Microsoft evil? That's a good conversation. I don't think when it comes to Canonical or Red Hat that it actually plays that much a role, because I feel, and maybe this is just my optimism and, you know, happiness of being part of the community, but I feel that Canonical and Red Hat, they're much more, it feels like they're invested in making the Linux community and the open source community better, because they not only do that, does their business rely on it, but because that's what they were founded on. You know, like, they're not like Microsoft, where they, you know, they built their empire on proprietary software and doing all the stuff to make as much money and get as big as possible. Like, that's not how Canonical was started. Canonical was started because, you know, they were started inside the FOSS community, and everything that they do, for the most part, you know, kind of bleeds into all of that stuff. And it just, it makes the feel of that corporation different than something like Google or Microsoft, right? It just makes it feel like they're more moral. Now, it doesn't mean that they're always that way.
I think you hit the head on the nail when you said altruistic, because I think that's really what it is people have this idea that these companies should be more like idealistic like they are, or they should be more. I guess there's, for a lot of people, there is, not for a lot of people, but I'm pretty sure most of us have probably talked to this person, but I know I have definitely come across the person who is very, very idealistic, which is not a bad thing, but they're very idealistic. And there's that, if you're hyper idealistic, there is an aversion to things that are coming out of straight, like, profiteering, just like wanting money. I think there's a drive for some people to want these FOSS corporations to be as idealistic as some of the people or themselves in the FOSS community. And I don't think that everyone's this way, or that a large amount of people are, but there's definitely those idealists that want Ubuntu, Canonical, Red Hat, OpenSUSE to be more idealistic instead of, obviously, a company that's driven by money, not just by spreading ideals. And while I understand how you can think that way, I don't think it's very beneficial. I think it's good to have a company that is just still a company trying to make money, but is more beholden to what people think about it, just because of the nature of what it is. Like, if you're a FOSS project, you have alternatives. But, like, by definition, what you are, anybody can fork you. Anybody can have an alternative to what you are. And I think that means that by that design, even a company, even something that's profit-driven, is more beholden to what people think about it. Because if you have alternatives, if you have options that you can use in your use case, then you don't have to use it. So as a company, if you're still profit-driven, you still have to care what people think about it.
A good example of that is CentOS, right? When CentOS, mm-hmm. when they changed the CentOS stream, you know, a lot of people said, like, what the hell? Like, this is not the way I want to use CentOS. So it was forked into Alma Linux and Rocky Linux. Like, and now those things mm-hmm. are popular again. You know, and that's the way, you know, people are using those. So that's a good example of that. So the last thing I wanted to talk about, you know, we're not going to get into politics, so we won't get into any of that stuff. But one of the things that I just, maybe it's a little naive of me. Like, it's possible that I'm just being completely naive and over-optimistic, idealistic, as you put it. But I don't think, it doesn't feel to me that Canonical's in it for the money. Like, hold on a second. I know that they're in it for some money, but I don't think that they're in it to make the most money. Like, if they were in it just for the money, they had no other motives other than to make the most money, they would have went IPO years ago. You know what I mean? They would have went public years ago, and that's how you make money. That's the reason why Red Hat was so much bigger in terms of money than Canonical is. So for example, and I'm pretty sure, hopefully my example here is going to pan out, but Ubuntu or Canonical employs 505 people. I'm very curious how many Red Hat employs. They started out as, they employ 19,000 people. So there's, you know, a little bit of a difference there. You know what I mean? And you got to remember, Red Hat went public a long time ago, and they made more money, right? That's the reason why they were able to get bigger than Canonical has. So it feels to me, at least in terms of the Canonical argument, is that Mark Shuttleworth and the people who run Canonical have not necessarily completely different goals than a corporation would have, because they obviously do want to make money, but it's not their sole focus. And because if it was, like I said, they would have went public. They would have gotten to the... I mean, if they went public, they'd be worth 10 times more than they are right now. Their revenue in 2020 was $141 million. You know what I mean? They would have made a lot more than that if they'd went public a couple years ago or whatever. Maybe not now, but...
Well, I completely agree with you because I think they have been smart with it. They're obviously a company. They pursue money. But they're not... I think they've been smart in not letting the pursuit of money make bad, potentially bad business decisions. Because when you go public, you're beholden to like shareholders and investors. And essentially, if there is a way that you could have made more money, but you didn't do it, and if you can't prove that having made that more money would have cost you more revenue down the line in public perception or whatever, if you can't prove that, then you essentially legally have to do what you need to make that extra cash, like no yeah. matter how immoral it is.
Because when you go public, you're beholden to your shareholders, like 100% yep. beholden to your shareholders. It's one of the reasons why like Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, they have to have these obligations to their shareholders. I think that's definitely one of the reasons that Canonical hasn't gone public yet. Like they want,
yeah, and that means like, because a good example is if they were a publicly traded company and with the Amazon deal, because I'm sure they stood to make quite a bit of money off of Amazon for that. So when the public backlash came out about that, there's a good chance they, even if they did roll back on deploying it, it probably could have taken much longer because essentially on their end, there's a very good chance that they might have to prove that they're even able to do that. Because if you stand to make, as a publicly traded company, if you stand to make money doing something and you choose not to do it, there's a big, like, you open up a big legal liability for you. And with Canonical never going public, it means that they have the right to make those kind of business decisions that might hurt them in the short term, but definitely help them in long-term perception and potential revenue. If we're being honest, on the desktop, if every time you installed Ubuntu, still to this day, every time you wanted to search for an application, you got Amazon search results, I don't know that Ubuntu would be where it is still today. I think much fewer people would still be using Ubuntu. Not because people don't use Amazon, but I mean, it's you're in the Linux space, free and open source, you know, kind of, oh, I don't know, semi-privacy focused.
Yeah, I don't...
Having Amazon.
I know some people really cared about that Amazon icon on the desktop. A lot of people really cared about that, but they had that thing on there for 10 years. It didn't... Then they were still growing a lot at that point, right? Did they grow more?
Well, the Amazon desktop icon is different than having... Literally every time you search for a file or an application on your system, it pull up Amazon search results.
Yeah.
That one, I understand why people were really not okay with that one. But getting upset that they had essentially a hyperlink to Amazon installed, like, come on, man. Like, that's so easy to remove, you shouldn't even be talking about it. Like, it's fine. But... Like, I don't know. Some people got really upset about that, which I don't understand. But I can definitely understand the search thing. That one was a little bit stretchy.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. With the public backlash, they roll back on it. I don't. Public companies, it's really hard to say whether or not they can do that. And that's probably why it takes Microsoft so long, like as a publicly traded company, to do something about a problem that they're having. Because they also... license, like with your Microsoft license, like you essentially have like warranty and like a legal way of going after them should they not hold up their end of the deal, which is providing you a working operating system. So like for them to roll back or change things based off of public backlash, like it actually takes them time to do it, especially if it's a monetary deal.
So I may be wrong in my knowledge, like it's 100% possible. I don't deal in stocks and bonds, and I don't own corporations, you know, any of that kind of stuff, right? But I think that when you're a public company, everything you do has to be in the goal of making the shareholders more money, right? Yes. That's a legal thing that you have to do. Like, that's the reason why when Facebook decided they were going to spend $10 billion on their metaverse stuff, right? They had to show their shareholders that this thing here, yes, we're spending a lot of money on it. We're not going to make any money on it for a long time, but it's going to eventually be profitable. That's the whole thing of a business, right? What would worry me if Canonical ever went public, which I think they probably will, is how do they justify the Ubuntu desktop? Because the Ubuntu desktop is never, ever going to make them money. Like, the public-facing Ubuntu desktop.
Well, make them enough revenue to justify how much work they put into
it. Right.
I think that's the good one. Because it definitely does make money, but not enough, probably, to justify how much work they put into it.
I don't know if you can really say that it does make... I mean, because that, like, and I'm talking about the actual, like, desktop, like the GNOME desktop when you boot into the latest version of Ubuntu. I don't know how that, because the vast majority of their, actually all of their revenue, other than donations, comes from the enterprise. And I mean, I'm sure there's some corporations out there that actually use Ubuntu desktop. So you're probably right. It does make some money in that sense. But I think that the number of corporations that actually use Ubuntu desktop is probably pretty really freaking small. The vast majority of people who use Ubuntu are using it on servers, which is completely headless, right? That doesn't come with GNOME or anything like that. So it would be interesting to see how they would justify the continuing existence, because that probably, I mean, yes, it probably does bring in some money, but you're right. The amount of effort and development, development that put into it.
Well, I mean, if we're being honest, most likely all donations that Ubuntu receives based just from their website or however they take their donations, which I think it's through their website, whatever. I would assume those, like, donations would fall under, Ubuntu's desktop revenue, like what it brings in. But even if we're being honest, most likely the amount of revenue that they get through their website and just end user, regular Joe Schmo donations probably pays for one developer in an entire year. Probably. Maybe an very expensive developer, maybe almost two developers, I don't know. But I would assume it's probably one to two developers is what it pays for. And I can pretty much guarantee you Ubuntu has more than just one dude who works on their Ubuntu desktop project. Like, there's definitely more than just one guy who's like, oh yeah, the next Ubuntu desktop release is done. I finished it up.
Sravan, or however you say his name, told us to stop speculating. Like, if we stop speculating on this podcast, we wouldn't have a podcast. Half this podcast is speculation.
and you kind of have to, because there is no, you can't just iron it down. You have to speculate at some of this stuff, because they just don't have it publicly available. They're not a publicly traded company.
Like, we know how many employees they have, but we don't know what those employees are doing. For all we know, half of them are probably trying to make the Firefox snap faster and realizing that, oops, we can't. You know? I mean, so we don't really know what they're doing. Okay.
But, yeah, I think, long story short, Canonical is not evil. They just are a company, and that comes with a healthy amount of distrust inside of the Linux community, which is not a bad, again, healthy amount of distrust. Some people have just a distrust completely of companies in general, but I think in the Linux community, you could definitely say that there is a general distrust of companies. And it's a good thing, especially in Canonical's case, because it keeps them in check. They actually, because they do have easy competition. Like, if you have a problem with Ubuntu, even as a company, worst case scenario, you just move to something like Red Hat or OpenSUSE. Like, you can do that. It's not a non-option. It's definitely available. So I think by nature of them being a FOSS company, they're not as evil as some people would like to think they are. They have to be a little bit more open to what the feedback is from the public. I don't think they're evil. I just think they make mistakes, which, I mean, it's a company. It's made up of people. People make mistakes. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. I just think people get very hyperbolic about it.
One thing I love about the Linux community is that people care, right? I mean, people mm-hmm. truly, honestly, there's a reason why there's a, I use Arch, by the way. Like, people really, truly love Arch Linux. People really, truly love Gentoo. They get really very possessive of their Linux distribution, right? And I think that that's a great thing. I think that it does lead to some dickish behavior from time to time. It definitely does. But I think that that sense of ownership that you get by even just installing Linux, like, you're part of something now. Like, even if you don't contribute anything, you know what I mean, you're still a part of it, right? And the more you get involved in the Linux community, whether it's just helping people or whatever, the more that kind of sense of entitlement, it's not really entitlement, more the sense of belonging that you get kind of grows, right? And when you have that sense of belonging and, like, you're part of the Linux community and you feel like you're – like, maybe your opinion doesn't matter a lot, but you have the ability to voice your opinion and people, you know, listen to it. Maybe you have a YouTube channel or you talk in Discord to people or you're a member of the forums or whatever. You know, you say something and people listen, right? I think that a lot of the ideas and the reason why people care so much about the things that Canonical does is because it feels like they're a corporation that is part of that community, part of that, you know, thing that you have a part of. And when you're a part of something, you have really strong thoughts on it. And especially when the corporation that you kind of want to look up to, like, I think a lot of people want to look up to Canonical, and when they make a poor decision, that kind of, it hurts, right? It makes you passionate about trying to say, you know, I don't really agree with this. I want you to change it, you know, and some of that does come across as, you know, entitlement, but some of it also is just because people care. I mean, yes, people care about the changes that Microsoft makes to, like, Windows 11. Like, there was a big outcry over a lot of the changes in Windows 11, right? But there's a difference because in the FOSS community, when something is done to a project that you use, you have the ability to influence the developer in a way that you don't have with Microsoft. Microsoft is going to do the thing that they want to do absolutely no matter what, okay? They want Windows 11 to look like this way and function this way, and that's the way it's going to be. You don't like it, go use a Macintosh or go use Linux, right? That's their thing, right? They're never going to change. The thing is with the reason why Canonical is – you look up to Canonical because when you – and like every FOSS developer, because you can interact with them, like you can talk to people who are at Canonical right now. A lot of them are very active on Twitter and forums and stuff like that. And they, because you can talk to them, they are influenced way more than Microsoft ever will be by the community. And that's just the case. Like, that's just the way it is. And that's what makes it kind of special. And it's also why it makes it so disappointing when they make a decision that's going to, negatively affect the community. So to answer the question, no, I don't think they're evil. I just think that they're more susceptible and more part of the community than Microsoft ever would be. So anyways, that is the main topic. I'm honestly surprised at how much we actually managed to get out of that topic. So I'm pretty happy with that. Mm-hmm. So moving on to the last section, which is creatively named. I think it's like very creatively named, the thingy of the week. Now, we could have called this anything. We could have called this picks of the week, apps of the week. It still says apps of the week in the docs, actually. But we call that the thingy of the week. So, Tyler, what is your thingy of the week?
Well, mine is something that probably people are going to just rage at, so I'm just going to be prepared for this. So I've been checking out Google Stadia and GeForce Now, and I'm going to go ahead and say GeForce Now does not work on OpenBSD. Can't get GeForce Now working.
You should use a real operating system.
So, I've been checking out Google Stadia, and it's kind of freaking awesome. It's real good. I really hate it because I'm torn because of how, like, I hate it because it's good. If that makes any sense, I hate it because it does. It's not like GeForce Now where it's my own Steam library. I have to purchase games from them, or I can pay $10 a month and I just get like a shitload of free games given to me each month, and then I can buy the ones that I don't have or whatever. But I have to build up an entire separate library in Google Stadia, which is just no. I'm not paying for games separately. Thanks, buddy. You get them. But yeah, I've actually really liked Google Stadia. It's working extremely well, and they've got a crap load of games. So yeah, if you have good internet but you don't have a really nice computer, and you've tried GeForce Now and it didn't work great, give Stadia a try. I'm not saying buy it, because you don't have to. If you want to place, just in your browser, check it out, see how it works, or just get to play some free games that you might not have. If you go to Stadia's website and then click on games, they will give you like six to ten games that you can just play. They'll give you an allotted time, and you can just play them essentially for free for an allotted time and have some fun. So yeah, at the very least, as long as you got good internet and you've wanted to try it out, give it a shot, because you can for free. It's pretty nice. Mm. I like it. So,
yeah. I use Stadia like one or two times, I think. But you know me, I'm not much of gamer. All right, so my thingy of the week is actually one that I've used before. So I know what you're thinking, Matt. You're recycling things, but it's different because it used to be called Keymapper, and it allowed you to remap buttons on your keyboard or your mouse or whatever, and it was good. But now it's actually called Input Remapper, and it's expanded beyond just your keyboard and mouse. It can literally do anything that's attached to your computer as long as it recognizes it. And you can assign any of those buttons that you have. So it has a much broader range of hardware that it will recognize, which is cool. And I've been using it now because I talked a couple weeks ago about how I started to use the Ellicom Huge, the trackball again. And mm-hmm. I'm still on it. It's really good. Like, I hated it at first. Like, I talked about it on the podcast a few months ago when I first got it. I did not like it because it was not accurate. But I've been using it now, and it's broken in. And, like, it's really good. But it has three extra buttons on it that they're, like, function buttons. And you can assign those to things. But obviously, because I'm on Linux, you don't have, like, access to the software or anything. Input Remapper allows me to remap those buttons. So I've remapped them to, like, OBS short keys, which is cool. So I can just put these little buttons. The only problem I have with it is it doesn't work all that well as a service. So it does come with a systemd service, and it's supposed to start up with your computer, right? It doesn't really work. So you actually have to start up the program every time you restart your computer in order to get the key bindings to register, which is disappointing. But other than that, it's really kind of good. So if you want to like add layers to your keyboard, and you don't have access to like the Windows software, this would be really good. So that's Input Remapper. The links to all that stuff will be in the video description. Coming up next week, I'm not actually sure what we're going to be talking about next week. I think we're going to be talking about containers. So we're going to be really nerdy about containers next week. So that should be fun. So anyways, before I go, I should take a moment to thank my current patrons, which I can do by running this really cool video here. If you want to support me on Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/linuxcast. I really truly do appreciate all of you who support me on Patreon and YouTube. I can't even begin to say how much I truly appreciate all the support that you guys have given me over the last year and a half. It really, truly does mean the world to me. So, thanks to all of you who support me. We will be back next week. We record this live every Friday between 3 and 3:30-ish or so. We're never on time. So, sometime around 3 o'clock yep. Eastern time, we record this on Fridays, and then the podcast goes up on Friday for audio listeners only. So, anyways, we will be back next week. We'll see you then.
Bye.